This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.
That brings us, secondly, to the lure of beauty. This is a companion to the voice of holiness. We could say that the Greek tradition honors the holiness of beauty, the Hebrew tradition, the beauty of holiness. What Lewis was in the process of learning is that holiness and beauty are two dimensions of one great reality. Point number one, at Oxford and in the war, ages 18 to 19. It would be years before Lewis discovered joy in God. He didn't become a theist until 1929. And a Christian theist in 1931. So we're about 10 or 12 years before that. We return to Lewis, the atheistic teenager, working under W.T. Kirkpatrick. We noted earlier that Kirkpatrick was preparing Lewis to sit for exams for entrance into Oxford University. He passed those exams. He was admitted to Oxford. And in April of 1917... he began his studies there, April of 1917, but he was soon recruited into the British Army. He was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the light infantry and arrived on the front lines of France on his 19th birthday, November the 29th, 1917. You can read about his capture of 60 Germans in his autobiography. He says they just walked out and presented themselves, not like Sergeant York. He was wounded in April of 1918 by a British shell that fell short of its German target. So he was returned to a hospital in England where he had time for leisurely reading, not bothered apparently by the shrapnel in his chest. Arthur Greaves had suggested that the beauty of the world is to some degree an evidence of God. From the London hospital where he was recuperating, Lewis took vigorous hold of this idea and pressed it further than Arthur had imagined. Precisely where, Lewis asked, does the beauty of a tree reside? Like every other physical object, a tree is made up of atoms, and atoms are identical and without color. So when you call a tree beautiful, you're actually speaking of something other than the atoms of which it is made. A light from the vibrations in the distant sun produces a wave toward your eye. When it reaches the tissues of your eye, another vibration is set up and moves along a nerve like a telegraph wire, carrying the sensation to your brain. One such sensation we call greenness, another brownness, a third shapeliness, but there's no actual color either in the atoms of which the tree is composed or in all those vibrations. How then does the beauty of the tree arise? Shape, size, color, touch, and the like are simply the names we call our sensations, and no amount of study of them can ever bring us to the notion of beauty in the tree. Beauty must therefore arise from some non-material relation between the tree and myself. Quoted in Clyde Kilby's book, C.S. Lewis, Images of His World. Lewis concluded that beauty, capital B, was to be explained with reference to something right outside time and place, and that beauty is the call of the spirit of that something to the spirit in us. Just a couple of reflections upon that quotation. Given the juncture that he has reached in his intellectual pilgrimage, he can say some things really are more beautiful than others. It's wrong to say beauty is simply in the eye of the beholder. There's something beyond that which strikes you as beautiful that accounts for that property or that quality in the thing. Hold on a second. If you've read his book, Reflections on the Psalms, the chapter on praising, he says some things really are admirable. Not necessarily admired, but admirable. Some people who are captivated by the artwork in a comic book would be bored to tears by a tour through the National Gallery of Art. Some things, like the paintings of Rembrandt, are admirable, so that admiration is not wasted upon them. Even if no one admires them, they remain admirable. So Lewis had yet to learn that this something, notice the quote, this something is in fact someone. But to speak of a spirit of beauty beyond time and space was a great step forward for an atheist. Clay. Yeah. Yeah. And this is like, 13 or 14 years before he becomes a Christian. At this stage of his life, Lewis is like Mark Studdock, a character in That Hideous Strength, whose wife Jane is the central heroine of the book. Mark Studdock had grown up as an unbeliever and materialist. This is really autobiographical of Lewis, the portrait of Mark Studdock. He had no room for metaphysics. But then he is subjected to torture to confirm him in his materialism. And he finds that the idea of the straight and the normal grew stronger and more solid in his mind until finally it was like a kind of mountain. Mark had never before known what an idea meant. He'd always thought, until now, that they were things inside one's own head. You see the influence of Platonic idealism here. But under persecution, he came to understand that an idea is something that existed quite apart from himself, and had hard rock surfaces which would not give, surfaces he could cling to. Somewhere outside the cosmos is the idea or ideal of the good, capital G. Then influences at Oxford. First of all, Christian authors. This is where it begins to get exciting. His discharge from the army in January 1919, he returns to Oxford. He was discovering that the authors upon whom he could really feed were Christians. George MacDonald, G.K. Chesterton, large influence on Lewis's thinking. Compare Chesterton's orthodoxy to Lewis's mere Christianity. Samuel Johnson from an earlier generation. Edmund Spencer, John Milton. Lewis was disconcerted to run into a whole nest of men who were both Christians and intellectuals. At one point, he thought that was an oxymoron, a Christian intellectual. That's an oxymoron like married bachelor or family vacation or some would say military intelligence. Or Lebanese government. He came to notice a wide gap between mere morality and holiness in certain men. He adapts a line from the Song of Roland, "Christians are wrong, but all the rest are boring." Where do you go from there? Christians are wrong, but all the rest are boring. One particular Christian was Owen Barfield. Barfield helped to destroy what Lewis calls his chronological snobbery. There's a key phrase. Chronological snobbery. The idea that whatever has gone out of date is therefore discredited. We'll have more to say about that later, but it's all around us, brothers and sisters. If it's out of date, it's discredited. The newer the better, the more intellectually sound. This helps to explain why in the end Lewis would become extremely suspicious of modernity. It reminds me of a Gary Larson cartoon. This is sort of the contemporary mentality. Early archaeologists. Now take this granite bowl. It was dug up not far from here and probably dates back to, I'd say early July. That's chronological snobbery. The other major Christian influence among Lewis's contemporaries was J.R.R. Tolkien, the creator of this marvelous mythology typified by the trilogy The Lord of the Rings. Tolkien was both a Roman Catholic and a philologist, scholar of languages. Two things that Lewis, from Ulster Protestant stock, had been warned never to trust. We'll have more to say about Tolkien's influence in Lewis's conversion, especially with reference to myth became fact. It is interesting, isn't it, that Ransom, the central character in the Space Trilogy, is a philologist. So no doubt Tolkien helped to inspire that. The Screwtape letters are dedicated to J.R.R. Tolkien. Number one, God as cosmic reason. Captivated by the notions of holiness and beauty, Lewis first thinks of God in impersonal terms, as cosmic reason or beauty or goodness or the absolute. Now listen to this in view of what's coming. This is Lewis's expression of his own reasoning. There was, I explained, no possibility of being in a personal relation to him. This is all out of Surprise by Joy. For I thought he projected us as a dramatist projects his characters. And I could no more meet him than Hamlet could meet Shakespeare. I didn't call him God. I called him Spirit. One fights for one's remaining comforts, he says. Point number two, the Hound of Heaven. What happens next is captured in the hymn, I sought the Lord, and afterward I knew he moved my soul to seek him seeking me. Although Lewis would change one of the lines. Listen to these words from Surprise by Joy. Amiable agnostics will talk cheerfully about man's search for God. To me, as I then was, they might as well have talked about the mouse's search for the cat. Imagine a mouse searching for a cat to be devoured. You must picture me alone in that room in Magdalen, his college at Oxford. Night after night, feeling whenever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him whom I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God, and knelt and prayed. perhaps that night the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England. I did not then see what is now the most shining and obvious thing, the divine humility which will accept a convert even on such terms. The prodigal son at least walked home on his own feet. But who can duly adore that love which will open the high gates of heaven to a prodigal who is brought in kicking, struggling, resentful, darting his eyes in every direction for a chance of escape? The words compelle intrare, compel them to come in, from the parable of Jesus, have been so abused by wicked men that we shudder at them. Properly understood, they plumb the depth of divine mercy. The hardness of God is kinder than the softness of men, and His compulsion is our liberation. Notice the point He's making in that closing sentence. How many a manipulative evangelist has compelled a person to come in, to yield a pressure that's anything but of divine origin? But if the pressure comes from God, then, brothers and sisters, you begin to understand irresistible grace. At this point, Lewis is Calvinistic. Why do we call it irresistible grace? Because there's something deep within the fallen self that will resist grace. That resistance must be overcome. John 6, verse 44. Jesus says, "No one can come to me unless the Father draw him." The verb is strong. Unless the Father drag him. Helkuo. Not just woo, but drag. I think we must at this point offer a balancing statement about the place of joy in Christian conversion. Lewis's own writings would have us say that when he comes to Christian theism, it's not just that he's dragged in against his will, but together with that, wanting to hang on to one's own egocentrism is the lure of joy that draws him together with this. And then conversion to Christian theism. Number one, myth became fact. Lewis was not yet a Christian. He believed in God, but he did not yet believe that Jesus was the Son of God, God the Son. At this point, he would be in the position of an Orthodox Jew, monotheistic, but not a Trinitarian. Lewis had long thought that those Teutonic and Norse myths were more exciting than the Christian myth about Jesus. This story, he said to Tolkien, is not nearly so exciting as the story of Siegfried and the Ring of the Nibelung. Tolkien helped Lewis to realize that the Christian story was the myth that came true, the myth that became fact, eternity, intersecting time. There's an essay under that very title in God in the Dock. Myth became fact. Lewis also recalled some words spoken by the toughest atheist he'd ever known. This is actually quoted in the earlier filming of Shadowlands that featured Josh Eklund in the title, in the role of Lewis. "All that stuff about the dying God, it almost looks as if it had really happened once." You don't go from the cycle of nature to a Christian myth. You go from myth became fact to understanding the cycle of nature. It explains everything. Number two, Shakespeare and Hamlet. Here's his chain of reasoning. Number one, there was no possibility of being in a personal relationship with him, for I thought he projected us as a dramatist projects his character, and I could no more meet him than Hamlet could meet Shakespeare. Second stage of reasoning. My own analogy, as I now perceived, suggested the opposite. If Shakespeare and Hamlet could ever meet, it must be Shakespeare's doing. Shakespeare could, in principle, make himself appear as author within the play and write a dialogue between Hamlet and himself. Very suggestive analogy, is it not? Because Shakespeare would remain the author even as he became a character. It's an image of incarnation. Jesus in eternity and in time. Not leaving eternity, coming into time, not interrupting his eternal being, but simultaneously with it. This is from Surprise by Joy, pages 223 to 227. If you've ever seen an Alfred Hitchcock movie, you know how the director, by his own initiative, has a cameo appearance, getting off a bus or something, toward the beginning of the movie. See the importance of the initiatives of God. Shakespeare to Hamlet, God to man. Number three, a visit to Whipsnade Zoo. Lewis took the final step in 1931, 2 years after his conversion to theism. This is what he says in Surprise by Joy, page 237. I know very well when, but hardly how, the final step was taken. I was driven to Whipsnade Zoo one sunny morning, riding in the sidecar of his brother's motorcycle. When we set out, I did not believe that Jesus is the Son of God. And when we reached the zoo, I did. No clanging bells, but a genuine conversion. That brings us to the theme of Lewis the Apologist. We're moving from Lewis the Convert to the Christian faith to Lewis the Advocate of the Christian faith. William F. Buckley, Jr., spokesman for American conservatism, calls Lewis the most persuasive apologist of his generation. And we all understand that the word apologist does not mean that we're embarrassed. We're not apologizing for the faith. We're defending the faith. It goes back to the Greek noun apologia, a defense. Most of Lewis's apologetic writings were penned about 50 or more years ago. The three great apologetic works, Problem of Pain, appeared in 1942. The Abolition of Man, 1946, and Miracles, 1947. Conferring with one of my philosopher friends who's read Lewis, he confirms me in the belief that Lewis's apologetics are as alive and vital today as they were 50 or 60 years ago. There's actually a lot of New Age thinking that's assaulted in Lewis before that label was ever used. You read the Four Loves and you read the Screwtape Letters about false spiritualities, and it's remarkably prophetic. Not only so, the naturalism, which is the main target of the apologetics of miracles, is still the underlying scientific assumption in our day. First, interpreting modern man. First, a philosophical perspective, and then an historical one. First, naturalism. The dominant philosophical system in today's Western world is naturalism, the belief that nothing exists except nature. By the way, I commend to you the chapter on naturalism in James Sire's book, The Universe Next Door, especially the revised edition, which includes a chapter on New Age thought. The astronomer Carl Sagan is a highly visible naturalist, often appearing on talk shows, not so much now as when he came out with his book, Cosmos. Opening sentence of that book is that the cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be. Carl Sagan is a thoroughgoing naturalist. The universe is all that ever was, that is, or ever will be. Some of you may know the name of Philip Johnson, two of whose works have been published by InterVarsity Press. The first is Darwin on Trial. The second, published just last year, Reason in the Balance, The Case Against Naturalism in Science, Law, and Education. Philip Johnson says, naturalism is the true creed of contemporary science. Looking at that latter book, Reason in the Balance, I was curious, I was a little surprised that it contains no reference to Lewis's arguments in his book, Miracles, which would be very apposite at many points. Point number two, naturalism's view of origins. It really comes down to this, to use Francis Schaeffer's formula. The impersonal plus time plus chance equals the universe. The impersonal plus time plus chance equals the universe. And given the complexity and the character of the universe, no wonder you have to have millions and millions of years for it to have come to its present state. Here's a quotation from Mere Christianity. Matter and space just happen to exist and always have existed, nobody knows why. The matter behaving in certain fixed ways has just happened by a sort of fluke to produce creatures like ourselves who are able to think. By one chance in a thousand, something hit our sun and made it produce the planets. And by another thousandth chance, the chemicals necessary for life. And the right temperature occurred on one of these planets. And so some of the matter on this earth came alive. And then by a very long series of chances, the living creatures developed into things like us. You don't have to remember all that. The impersonal plus time plus chance over millions and millions of years equals the universe. In other words, if you had a group of chimpanzees who were healthy and hardy, you could set them down before keyboard on a personal computer, and given time, they will type out the plays of Shakespeare. It's not going to happen over the weekend, but if you allow for computers that will function for millions of years, and chimpanzees who can survive for that long, they will eventually type out all the plays of Shakespeare, all the works of Dante, the whole Bible, everything. Thomas Howard, who's a disciple of Lewis, a classmate of mine at Wheaton College who was Protestant and became Roman Catholic, really captured the distinction between naturalism and supernaturalism in the title of one of his books, Chance or the Dance. Chance or the Dance. Now, thirdly, naturalism's God. First, the élan vital. This is a French phrase for life force. Lewis argues in Miracles that one can remain a naturalist and yet believe in a certain kind of God, to which the processes of nature give rise. What we may call an emergent God. Compare some forms of process theology. You could put it like this. In Christian theism, you have God's creative power initiating a natural process. In naturalism, you have this life force emerging within natural processes. What could be called creative evolution, where the creativity is embedded within the evolutionary spiral, striving upward toward perfection. This life force lacks mind and purpose and is itself subject to all these natural processes. There's no room for an intervention from outside the process. But, says the naturalist, look all around you. Look at yourself. What a miracle. You're no longer green slime. You have evolved out of that primal amoeba-like substance. And you go to the zoo sometime and look at some of your forebears. What a miracle that you're no longer an ape. You're the naked ape. What a miracle, all within this process. Here's a quotation from letter 22 of the Screwtape Letters. Remember, this is the demonic point of view. Transformation proceeds from within and is a glorious manifestation of that life force which our Father, that is our Father below, would worship if he worshiped anything but himself. We'll see a little bit later, this life force is a marvelous object of worship. All the blessings, none of the demands. Point B, pantheism. Worship of a life force is a form of pantheism in which everything equals God. Pan, everything, theos, God. Nature is the being of God. If it did not exist, he would not exist. If we were to, if the natural world were to become extinct, there would no longer be God. He lives in, by, with, and under natural processes. Naturalism's God is the indwelling God. You can see this in the ancient Baalism. The God dies in the fall as the leaves fall from the tree, and he rises again in the spring as the flowers begin to bud. You can see it in sexual reproduction. God reproduces himself within the natural processes. Point number four, naturalism's irrationality. One of my students who had studied here under Ron Nash said that according to Ron Nash, naturalism is self-referentially absurd. I wish I'd thought of that. Self-referentially absurd. Naturalism's irrationality. Think about it. If nature comes into being and maintains itself by the operation of the impersonal plus time plus chance, then all thinking beings are themselves part of that process. How can I be sure that my own thinking is not subject to randomness and to chance? How can I trust my reflections upon this process? How can I trust my philosophical naturalism if the very processes of my mind are part of the impersonal plus time plus chance, how can I trust them? As Lewis points out in Miracles, for human reason to be trusted, it would have to stand outside that process. So-called rational thought is itself the result of irrational causes. This is tremendously important. If, for example, a Freudian argues that all thoughts are merely due to complexes, to be consistent, this Freudian psychotherapist would have to include the thoughts which constitute that very argument. Your thoughts are due merely to complexes. What about his thoughts that analyze my complexes? Are they themselves subject to complexes? How do I know that the psychiatrist who counsels me is not being governed by complexes and neuroses of his own, which distort his analysis of me? Naturalism's amorality. Naturalism, by its very nature, denies the transcendent God. The life force provides no basis for moral judgments. In pantheism, there's no room for moral distinctions, is there? If God is all, then God embraces both good and evil. In fact, you have no basis for distinguishing good from evil. Compare the force of Star Wars. I remember how startled I was to discover in the film Star Wars that both Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Vader appeal to the Force. Both beings good, and nobody could doubt that Obi-Wan Kenobi was good and Darth Vader evil. His black costume showed that. And yet they both appeal to the Force. Listen to Shirley MacLaine in her book Dancing in the Light. Until mankind realizes there is in truth no good and there is in truth no evil, there will be no peace. Our conflicts arise from the belief that good opposes evil. The way to peace is to blend them together to end the existence of both. I've been fascinated, I'm trying to write a book on spirituality, to look at New Age spirituality vis-a-vis naturalism. New Age thought is both rooted in and a reaction against naturalism. Dostoevsky said, hold on a second, if God is denied, everything is permitted. That's why today we talk about acceptable and appropriate behavior rather than sinful and wrong behavior. And what is the basis for acceptability? Why is it any better for me to help an old lady across the street than to push her under a car? My colleague at RTS Jackson, John Currid, told me about a passage in Jean-Paul Sartre he had run across. Sartre was sitting at one of these French sidewalk restaurants, and with a knife he was cutting a piece of cheese. And he looked across at another table and saw a lady sitting there. And he said, what difference is there between my cutting this piece of cheese with this knife and plunging it into that woman's brain through her eye? If you're a thoroughgoing existentialist, you have no basis for making those moral distinctions. The usual answer is, why is it better to cut the piece of cheese rather than to murder your neighbor? Because survival is desirable and death is not. Survival becomes a supreme value. Screwtape realizes that back in the early... Yes, question.
Somewhat related, but my question in this whole is, how do you deal with the cosmic amnesia that we must face if we are really take a pantheist view, and that I'm God and God is me. It's like, how do you deal with cosmic amnesia? And I don't know if that's... In other words, I'm God, but I don't know it. I've forgotten it somehow. And that philosophy just pervades some of the reading I've done in pantheism, is that I'm God, but I don't yet know it. And it's like, how could I forget that I'm God?
Well, the evangelists for the varieties of New Age thought are seeking to stir that consciousness back into you at the deepest level of your being. Cosmic consciousness in which you create your own reality, which is no better and no worse than anyone else's reality. It's hard for me to advocate that position because it's so utterly opposed to reality that an evangelist, to my mind, has a very difficult time of succeeding at that quest.
Within you both it is realizing that's what you are. Oh my God, that's what enlightenment is. No, that's
it. Yes.
Are you getting this from Timothy Leary?
It could have been. No.
He said, be your own God, create your own Bible, write your own religion.
Just reading the obituaries of Timothy Leary's death at the age of 75 was just deeply saddening. Deeply saddening.
Well, he said he'd be back.
Let's look at number 6, naturalism's enthronement of the self. On naturalism's view, humanity must take the place once reserved for God. This aspiration is eloquently expressed by John Steinbeck in his acceptance speech for the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1962. I love Steinbeck's novels, East of Eden and The Grapes of Wrath especially. But here is naturalism and the enthronement of the self eloquently expressed. I hold that a writer who does not passionately believe in the perfectibility of man has no dedication nor any membership in literature. We have usurped many of the powers we once ascribed to God. Fearful and unprepared, we have assumed lordship over the life or death of the whole world, of all living things. The danger and the glory and the choice rest finally in man. The test of his perfectibility is at hand. Having taken godlike power, we must seek in ourselves for the responsibility and the wisdom we once prayed some deity might have. Man himself has become our greatest hazard and our only hope. So that today, St. John the Apostle may well be paraphrased. In the end is the Word, and the Word is man, and the Word is with men. So the task of modern man, according to naturalism, is to subdue nature to man. Point 7, naturalism's enslavement of the will. If you're going to be a thoroughgoing naturalist, we've already noted you have no basis for moral judgments. And there's really no place in naturalism for freedom of will, is there? There's no place for freely and responsibly made moral decisions. For our decisions and actions are all determined by the whole complex of particulars that make up natural processes. Therefore, big therefore, behavior must be controlled by factors other than the moral. And this is where the metaphysical or philosophical behaviorism of B.F. Skinner comes in. In his book, especially, Beyond Freedom and Dignity. But then the question is, who will decide who shall be controlled? Who will govern the sociological establishment? That's a question that Schaeffer raised continually. Once we decide who our elite will be, who or what is to control them? By the way, the ultimate answer Lewis gives is in one of the most frightening books ever written, That Hideous Strength. We shall come back to this.
This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.